You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part A. Here's the continuation of The Life of the Party by Dan Adler. Reuben grew up in a middle-class family in a largely white suburb of Philadelphia. "I was always selling stuff," he said. At 14, it was used skis, then liquidated goods, then an e-commerce company, GSI Commerce, that he founded when he was 26, and that eBay bought for $2.4 billion in 2011. Fanatics was then a subset of GSI, and he bought it back from eBay to continue his ongoing expansion into sports, turning the operation into one that depended on the company's relationships and licensing deals with the major sports leagues. Last year, he sold his minority stakes in the 76ers and New Jersey Devils to avoid a conflict of interest when Fanatics got into the sports gambling business. The move came with some strife. Earlier this year, Fanatics offered the sports gambling operation PointsBet $150 million for its U.S. business. Jason Robbins, CEO of sportsbook rival DraftKings, announced a $195 million offer in response, which Reuben described at the time as a desperate attempt to slow Fanatics down. Reuben said he had been a friend to Robbins, who once stayed at his house. He raised his offer by $75 million and proceeded with the acquisition. "They just decided they wanted to be disruptive to us," he said. "That's a guy who wants to compete, but he's got the EQ of a gnat." "Michael is someone Jason considers a friend," DraftKings said in a statement. DraftKings' proposal to acquire PointsBet was solely a business decision that we felt was in the best interest of our company and shareholders at the time. "One thing I've learned," Reuben added, "is the bigger we get, the more people you have conspiring behind your back." In 2015, Reuben met Meek Mill. As each has often recalled, they were sitting courtside at the NBA All-Star Game. Meek was dating Nicki Minaj at the time, and Kylie, then 8, was a fan of hers and approached. Meek and Reuben started talking too. Neither knew who the other was, but they were from different parts of the Philadelphia area and stayed in touch. "My life was a lot simpler then," Reuben said. "We were hanging a lot, having fun together." Meek, then 27, had been on probation since he was a teenager, stemming from drug and gun charges. The conviction was eventually overturned. He had been trying to tell Reuben about the unfairness and precarity of his situation, but by Reuben's account, it just went in one ear and out the other. In 2017, Meek brought Reuben to a hearing about a pair of his recent parole violations, and Reuben was stunned to watch a judge sentence his friend to prison. "That was the most out of control I've ever felt in my life," he said. "Because here I am, and this relatively successful business person in the state that I grew up in, watching them put someone in jail for 2 to 4 years for not committing a crime." The case quickly became a go-to reference point in the national conversation around mass incarceration and prison reform. "Free Meek" was a rallying cry, and Reuben publicly campaigned on his behalf. "What's happening to Meek Mill is just one example of how our criminal justice system entraps and harasses hundreds of thousands of black people every day," Jay-Z, who had signed Meek to a management deal through Roc Nation, wrote in a New York Times op-ed. When Meek was released the following year, Reuben picked him up in a helicopter and brought him straight to a 76ers playoff game. The circumstances of this homecoming were widely publicized, And after Meek and Rubin reunited, they joined with Jay-Z and Kraft to create Reform Alliance, an advocacy organization focused on changing probation and parole laws. The group wasn't alone in an escalating celebrity sector of the movement. Rubin began working with Kardashian, who started studying law, and met with then-President Donald Trump concerning the case of Alice Marie Johnson. In 1997, Johnson was sentenced to life in prison on drug and money laundering charges. Trump pardoned her. As Rubin's company and his activism grew, so did his visibility. Along with Jay-Z, Meek, and others, he gave Kraft a Bentley for his 80th birthday in 2021. He had been a friend to athletes, to musicians, and now to a more general class of celebrity. Criminal justice issues had become a constant in his life. I'm, like, maniacally focused, but he has more recently noticed the winds shifting once more. The pendulum has swung back and forth, Rubin said. Think about it. No one cared about the issue when we started. Then everyone cared about it when George Floyd happened. No one cares about it again. As Rubin and Baby arrived in Philadelphia in June, they stepped aside for a rapt-looking conversation with 76er center Joel Embiid. Rubin, Embiid later said, stood apart from the other sports business figures he'd come into contact with over his career. He's willing to listen, he understands, and he's not afraid of controversy, he said. And he's a hard worker. That's the main thing. This dude don't stop. Gary Vaynerchuk, the advertising guru and irrepressible internet personality, a friend of Rubin's with his own rap-heavy Rolodex, defined himself and Rubin as purebred entrepreneurs. What I mean by that is you live it and breathe it. I think the reason both of us have found relationships in those genres is they are the other humans on Earth that are closest to you, Vaynerchuk said. In sports and music, you can't hide. Either there's 100 trillion downloads of your song, or there's not. Either you scored 42 points, or you didn't. Though he's keen on forging business partnerships with his friends, Rubin described a more emotional approach, too. When he, Embiid, Baby, and Meek recently flew to Las Vegas together, they discussed how they communicate with one another. Embiid told Rubin he didn't say love you growing up. But Joel says to me, love you, Rubin said. I say to Joel, love you. I say to Meek, love you. I say to Baby, love you. He grew more animated, extrapolating a few steps from the exchange he was describing. What the F do you mean we don't hug in our culture? I hug 6,000 people a day. Every day you see me, someone comes in, I give him a hug. Plenty of middle-aged white men, I proposed to Rubin, would love to be friends with famous, talented young black men. Before he and Vaynerchuk, there was Trump, who partied with rappers in Manhattan in the 90s, served as lyrical inspiration for more as the years went on, and pardoned Lil Wayne and commuted Kodak Black's sentence in 2021 after hosting Kanye West in the Oval Office. First of all, I don't feel middle-aged, Rubin said. And anyway, he pointed out, he has a more general agenda and cohort. The next day, he had a walk scheduled with Kraft at 7 a.m., where they'd discuss the Sun Valley Conference Kraft had just attended, and he had already talked to Brady four times that day. Next photos, heat seeker, at Rubin's white party. Justin and Hailey Bieber. Usher performs. Rubin with Kylian Mbappe, with Leonardo DiCaprio and guest, Jay-Z and Beyoncé. When I called Meek to hear his rendition of Rubin's foundational friendship, he spoke for 10 minutes without being asked much of a question. Mike made a vow to me just as a friend, Meek remembered. I'm not going to leave you in here by yourself. He seemed sensitive to the idea that Rubin had only recently come to the place he's in. Everybody wondering where Rubin came from. He just popped up on the scene to be around. but Meek pointed to business opportunities Reuben had steered him toward, as well as the duration of their relationship. In 2016, he was on house arrest, and Mike was in the house, just him and my whole black family, before any of this stuff took place. And now, he getting caught up in narratives. People be like, where'd Mike come from? Yo, Mike is just a young hustler who started a ski business early in Pennsylvania and turned it up. Leaving Philadelphia, Reuben and Baby hopped in an SUV and headed for the helicopter back to New York, returning a missed FaceTime call from Lala Anthony on the way. Baby had recently stayed in Reuben's West Village penthouse. Let's do dinner one night this week, Reuben suggested. Earlier in the day, he had recounted one of his first entrepreneurial conquests for Baby. Crazy story, he said. I don't know if you've ever heard this before. At 14, while operating his ski shop in the summertime, Reuben said he bought 40,000 pounds of ice cubes to make a slope in the parking lot. The novelty attracted press, but it would have been easier, he figured, if he had had the tools of social media at his disposal. Baby listened intently and a little wistfully. Maybe you could have been 100 times more successful, he said. Maybe 1,000,000 times.
Thank you.
chat person, muckraker of the moment, Kara Swisher, has seemingly every power player in Hollywood, media, and tech on speed dial. Now, as she tangles with Elon Musk and turns out podcast, the ultimate insider is running her own show by Charlotte Klein, with photographs by Gillian Laub. Opening photo shows Kara Swisher with her cat at the dining room table. Kara Swisher, rocking aviators, AirPods, and a Lesbians Who Tech sweatshirt, rolls into Vox Media's D.C. headquarters and gets right to work. Today's episode of On with Kara Swisher, a twice-weekly podcast that launched September a year ago, is about the future of the Republican Party after the House Speaker free-for-all, and she's tapped CNN's Manu Raju and The Bulwark's Charlie Sykes to make sense of the mess. Once the guests come on camera, Swisher apologizes for wearing sunglasses, explaining that she forgot her prescription pair at home. "It's very dark, Brandon," says Raju. "I had it before him," Swisher shoots back. "Let's be clear on that situation." Swisher, as an interviewer, shows little tolerance for bloviating. She gets to the point. About halfway through the episode, she calls for a lightning round of House Republicans, asking Sykes to tell us if the person is a true believer or a phony. Marjorie Taylor Greene. She is a conspiracy theorist, batshit crazy bigot, and anti-Semite, and for some reason that has made her a rock star in the Republican Party, says Sykes, a never-Trump-style conservative. And she's a believer. It's bullshit, but she believes in it. After wrapping up the podcast, her third taping that day, Swisher keeps up a rapid-fire patter with me. In the course of a few minutes, she bemoans the lack of entrepreneurial reporters, recalls a big fight with Roger Goodell after the NFL commissioner suggested her sons play football, and mentions talking the previous night with super agent Ari Emanuel about bull riding. But just like that, Swisher has to run, not to CNN, where she's booked to appear that night, but for drinks with executives from CNBC. She recently declined to re-sign her contributor contract with the network because she felt constrained by its exclusivity rules, and the money wasn't enough to keep me there. Now they've come to talk to her again. "I always get approached by the networks," Swisher tells me, "and they just never," she lets out an exasperated sigh, "they never know what they want to make," which is not a problem she seems to have. Beyond On, Swisher, 60, also hosts Pivot, a twice-weekly podcast with brash NYU marketing professor Scott Galloway, is writing a memoir about her beat reporting days, covering the dawn of the web, is working on a fictional TV show with another veteran Silicon Valley journalist, is advising Post News, a social platform she hopes will be a Twitter competitor, and is raising four kids, two of whom are toddlers. She has a coffee before bed every night, after midnight, Semaphore's Ben Smith text. This seems somehow emblematic to me, in a good way. Swisher, who is 5'2", but writes tall, as she likes to say, has carved a considerable niche for herself, cutting across television, the web, podcast, and social media, becoming the queen of all media, as veteran tech journalist Walt Mossberg puts it. A former Vox Media colleague is less charitable. She's always been searching for a way to make her platform even bigger, and she's done that. But it begins and ends with her. There's no legacy beyond that. Leaving legacy aside for the moment, Swisher has plowed a path through the media landscape alongside industry shifts from reporting at a newspaper to blogging to co-founding successful websites and conferences to becoming a brand unto herself. Part of a trend of elite journalists walking away from legacy outlets in pursuit of more freedom and potentially profits. Last year, she gave up a podcast and column at the New York Times, largely because, as she says, "I don't need Mama telling me what to do," and she stepped back from CODE, the iconic tech conference she'd organized and hosted for the past two decades. It was like painting the same painting over and over again, she tells me, and I just wanted to make something else. On is the sixth podcast Swisher has hosted, but it's the first where she owns the IP and has complete editorial control. She's riffed on Elon Musk and Mark Zuckerberg while expanding her aperture well beyond Silicon Valley, interviewing the likes of Darren Star and Gina Davis, and exploring topics ranging from comedy to death. Swisher's betting there's an audience willing to turn to her for more than just expertise on tech moguldom. I mentor a lot of people, and almost every single one of them is worried about losing their place if they step out of line. And I'm like, the only way you get higher is if you step out of line, Swisher tells me. That's the only way. Seriously. Unless you're untalented, and then you should stay in line. On a Monday afternoon in January, Swisher's house is chaotic, but the good kind. The kind you find in a place where life is happening. Toys are strewn everywhere, and a baby is laughing and sometimes crying, and the sink is running in the kitchen, where the golden child, as Swisher's three-year-old daughter is commonly referred to on her podcast, is about to have a snack. There's lots of talk of Elsa cheese, which is string cheese that Disney has branded with Frozen characters. The golden child crawls up onto the counter, where, at the opposite end, Swisher and her wife, the journalist Amanda Katz, are catching up on each other's day. How was the Scaramucci thing? Who won? Katz asked, referring to a public debate Swisher did that morning with financier Anthony Scaramucci on whether Elon Musk, whom Swisher has known and covered since the 90s, is killing Twitter. And the listener must remember that this article was written quite some time ago before Twitter became X. To continue, I did, obviously, says Swisher. I said he is, and it's killing Elon more than he's killing it. And then pivot was good, Swisher says. Scott made at least 14 prostitute jokes. Despite having a mini stroke a decade back, Swisher famously does not like taking time off and works around the clock. In December, she had heart surgery, and she was working the day before and the day after. That's not an exaggeration, Galloway tells me. When I ask Swisher how the surgery went, she replies, good, obviously. Her turbocharged work ethic could be traced in part to tragedy early in life. When she was five, her father died suddenly at 34 of complications from a brain aneurysm. Fresh out of the Navy and with three kids, he'd just purchased his first house and landed a gig as the head of anesthesia at the Brooklyn Jewish Hospital. He thought he was headed for the big time. He just died, fell over one day, and that has informed everything I've done. I'm like, I don't have time for this, says Swisher, adding, you don't have time either. Nobody has time. Swisher's mother remarried soon after to a cruel man whom Swisher couldn't say enough bad things about, but admits was a canny engineer. When Swisher was in sixth grade, they moved from Long Island to Princeton, New Jersey for his work, and when the rest of the family moved to California a few years later, Swisher stayed behind. I was like, I'm a yearbook editor. I have a boyfriend. F you, she recalls. I lived with friends and finished my senior year by myself, pretty much. Swisher knew she was gay from age four, but didn't have a girlfriend until college. At Georgetown School of Foreign Service, she studied propaganda, an education that shaped her view of misinformation and Donald Trump's manipulation of the media. I think I was one of the first to say there's real damage going on here, and we have to start paying attention to it, Swisher says. You have to be able to look at that and see what they're doing, even if you decry it and hate it. I was always interested in the moving of the Overton window. Swisher wanted to follow her father into the military. I thought I might go into the CIA, she says, but that would have required her to lie about being gay. I didn't even try. During college, she worked as a stringer for the Washington Post after complaining to then-Metro editor Larry Kramer about a sloppy story they'd published on a Georgetown event. Years later, after stints at Columbia Journalism School, a waste of money that she wished she'd invested in Apple stock instead, the Washington City Paper, and the political chat fest, the McLaughlin Group, whose host, the late John McLaughlin, she later testified against in a sexual harassment case, she returned to the Post, working her way up from style news aide to reporter on the local retail beat. "The Post is where I significantly started to use technology," says Swisher, recalling the K-Pro computer she used to lug around the office. Swisher put herself on the map nationally at the Post while covering the defining dot-com saga of the 90s, AOL, and its eventual disastrous merger with Time Warner. Kara always had this larger-than-life personality. I remember her as short, feisty, the kind of person who sets the room alive, recalls the Post David Ignatius, who was business editor when Swisher was writing for the section. She was a star. We knew we couldn't hold her. She left to write her first of two books on AOL, meeting Mossberg along the way. He recommended her for a job at the Wall Street Journal, where in 2003, the duo launched the All Things D Conference, a live journalism extravaganza featuring the biggest names in tech. It was at this conference in 2007 that Bill Gates and Steve Jobs took the stage together in an historic joint interview, and a few years later, where Zuckerberg broke into a profuse sweat amid questions about Facebook privacy. Kara's never ad hominem. She might be snarky, but she doesn't attack people. She attacks their actions and their ideas, Mossberg tells me. People feel that her interviews can elevate them, and sometimes it can hurt them, but that it's worth the price of admission, says veteran executive producer Tammy Haddad. A recent example is CNN chief executive Chris Licht, who, to put it mildly, got off to a rough start. It was strategic for Licht to give his first extensive interview to Swisher, a source close to the CNN chief acknowledges, as Swisher had the credibility to help reshape the narrative, but also would give the impression that Chris is pretty fearless because she's a tough interviewer. The success of the conference convinced Dow Jones to let Mossberg and Swisher start the All Things D blog. They left in 2013 to start their own venture, for which they'd raised $10 million in funding, taking the All Things D staff with them, and trying, unsuccessfully, to take the brand too. But Journal owner Rupert Murdoch, she says, wanted $10 million for the URL. "I wrote them back. I said, I can buy F.U. Rupert for $10. So All Things D became Recode, and the D Conference became the Code Conference. About a year and a half later, Vox Media purchased Recode in an all-stock deal. CEO Jim Bankoff, who first encountered Swisher as an AOL executive on the other end of one of her reporting calls, basically let her do whatever she wanted at Vox Media. Not long after the sale, Swisher stopped running Recode. "I hate managing," she says, and started the Recode Decode podcast. What really sold her on podcasting was the emotional attachment listeners felt to her as a host. Part of what makes Swisher so compelling is her ability to move between the personal and the work with ease, says New York Times CEO Meredith Kopit-Levien. Swisher noticed that her Geek Guy audience began to expand after venturing into podcasting, such as when four women of color, all entrepreneurs, approached her on the Muni in San Francisco. "Kara, it's you. I can't believe it. I'm like, this is not my effing demo," Swisher remembers. More recently, a firefighter made a 180 in the street in New York to take a selfie with her, she recalls. He's like, "I love you. I knew those NFTs were bullshit. Thank you for explaining it to me." She signed off as host of Recode Decode in July 2020. 5 years and more than 500 interviews later, By then, she'd started Pivot. The dynamic is Galloway as provocateur and Swisher reeling him in. Also in 2020, Pivot became part of New York Magazine, which Vox Media had acquired a year earlier. Despite the New York association, Swisher, who has two teenage sons with her first wife, former Google executive Megan Smith, is living in D.C. again. For most of our conversation at her home, she wears her signature aviator sunglasses until it's dark enough that she gets up to turn on a lamp. She has an eye condition that causes sensitivity to light. The aviators are a brand thing. The dark glasses are not, she explains. As we're talking, we are occasionally interrupted by other pieces of Swisher's life popping through the doorway. The cat, cats, and the golden child, who comes in to ask Swisher to help her put the shoe back on her Barbie. Fiddling with the plastic shoe, Swisher tells her daughter, "Honey, I never played with Barbies." Swisher tells me she did an interview with the CEO of Mattel and told him she hated Barbie. Afterward, he sent her a box of them. "I let her keep one, and I gave the rest to charity." The golden child leaves the doll on the table in front of Swisher, who proceeds for the next hour to stroke Barbie's hair while we talk. The word brand, it makes you feel like you're a jar of peanut butter, says Swisher, recalling how people used to lodge it as an insult. "I'm making something that has my name on it, and because of the new tools available to us through the internet, we can now get our voice out there in ways we couldn't," she says. "I think I was one of the first to say that to people, and obviously the people who run these places do not like that message. When I left the Journal, everyone suddenly was like, 'You can leave?' They were shocked," she whispers. "I was like, 'You can leave.'" "I'm trying to teach you that, right?" Swisher says to her daughter, who nods. "Yeah, you're going to do what you want to do." Another nod. "Yeah, good. You're going to watch Frozen all the time is what you're going to do." Swisher, lowering her voice, tells me it's heroin. I texted Bob Iger. I'm like, "Stop. You put it on cheese. What the F?" When I ask Swisher whether the success of Pivot has given her the freedom to turn down or leave other projects, she practically snorts. "I'll walk away from anything," she says. "I always feel like I can make something else." Case in point, the New York Times, where Swisher landed an opinion column in 2018. Then came Sway, a twice-weekly podcast about power that was meant to be a Terry Gross-type show. Hillary Clinton and Jane Goodall were early guests, but changed direction over time as it became more reactive to news. Some episodes made a splash, like one in the aftermath of the January 6th insurrection, in which Swisher pressed Parler CEO John Matz on the right-wing social media platform's role. Apple cited his comments on Sway in its decision to remove Parler from its app store. Matz was fired a month later, but then Swisher started to get itchy, as she puts it, particularly with the column, which she says can become a live coffin for people who stay too long. "I think most people have 40 good columns in them." And there was tumult at Sway. Six people left the Times after about a year or less of working on the show. It was totally known across the opinion audio department that this was a nightmare show to work for, says one Times staffer, who, along with three former opinion audio staffers, points to impossible deadlines and poor management. "There were months and months of interventions and people trying to fix it," the staffer says. When I ask Swisher how she felt she was as a manager on Sway, she says she wasn't one, she was talent. "Nobody reported directly to me," says Swisher. "I didn't hire them, I didn't fire them, I didn't do their reviews or anything like that. I wasn't involved in anybody's review, unfortunately." As for the turnover, she says, "I think it was that they didn't hire the right people in the first place, because I do news." I point out that Sway was a product of the opinion side of Times Audio, not its news division, which she dismisses as an irrelevant distinction. "When something happens, I want to do it right away, They just didn't want to move that way. I totally get it. I completely respect it. But I just didn't want to do the slower show. I wanted to do the fast burn show. And so it was a real struggle. Swisher started hosting conversations on Twitter Spaces. I was making something else. When I have four children, four podcasts a week, a column, what does that say to you? I'm not making what I want to make. She was also chafing against the Times bureaucracy. I just wanted to make what I wanted to make, and I didn't want to ask 86 people. They're all really smart. They just aren't me. New York Times opinion editor Kathleen Kingsbury applauded Swisher's unmistakable voice and says the section was grateful for her 4 years of reporting and commentary for us. As Swisher was getting increasingly restless at the Times, she was considering opportunities elsewhere, including the Washington Post, which was talking to her about a role-spanning podcast, live events, and columns. They wanted to bring in a star, and they just didn't want to pay, says Swisher. She went furthest down the road with CNN, which wanted her to host a show on CNN Plus and was offering millions of dollars, according to Swisher. Galloway had already signed his own deal to host a program on the forthcoming streaming service, but she was wary given the impending Warner Brothers Discovery merger. They're going to have to cut something big. And guess what's big and stupid? That, she said of CNN Plus, which Discovery quickly killed off. Next photo shows Swisher in the den of her house with her daughter in the background playing with dolls. Swisher wanted to make a different type of interview show, less formal than Sway and more about me, Swisher says. I just didn't think I could make it there. The audience was different. They weren't in on the joke. Over at New York, editor-in-chief David Haskell was on the same page. You know, I listened to it. I was sometimes jealous of it, he says of Sway, and there were ways in which I also thought we might be a better home for her. Once she decided to leave, Swisher first told Levian, the Times CEO, I didn't go to the editorial people. I knew they'd be hurt. They have a vision of nobody leaves the Times. But she got it right away, says Swisher. It was good to have her at the Times for the stretch we had her, and it makes sense to me why she moved on, says Levian, describing Swisher as a force in the industry. Over lunch at a Japanese restaurant in Cathedral Heights, I asked Swisher how much of her decision to leave the Times had to do with ownership. A lot, she says, between bites of salmon teriyaki. What was happening at the time is I find out that all the stuff at the Journal, the All Things D stuff, disappeared from the Internet, says Swisher. They were so careless with my stuff, she says. I've done 1,000 or more interviews. I own none of them. Meanwhile, there she was at the Times, growing something else that wasn't hers. I also wanted a piece of the revenue again, and the Times is not going to do that, sorry to tell you, she says. I was working at a discount at the New York Times for what I make. As Benkoff was preparing to launch The Verge in 2011, he decided to break the news in a co-exclusive with Swisher at All Things D and the late David Carr at The Times. She made it very clear to me that if I were to burn her, in other words, hold up information from her that Carr was getting, there would be repercussions, Benkoff recalled, laughing. I'm not exactly sure what those repercussions would be, but I knew then, and I know now, that you keep your word with Kara. I used to be so aggressive about that stuff. Not anymore. I don't care, Swisher tells me when I ask her about this story. Scoops don't matter anymore because they're so ephemeral, she says. Still, she bristles at the idea that she's not still reporting. I do reporting all the time, she tells me. It manifests itself in my interviews, says Swisher. I'm doing reported analysis now. I am not doing punditry. Even if she's toned down her reporting style, she's still seen as someone not to cross. Multiple people wouldn't speak to me for this story because they reminded me Swisher is a powerful person. She's willing to get into the brawl with me, Emmanuel, the Endeavor CEO, told me. likening his and Swisher's back and forths to the Friday night dinners at my house that I used to have. You had to come in with a strong argument and points of view and willing to throw blows and take blows. Emmanuel met Swisher more than a decade ago at a Silicon Valley gathering. She's somebody that when I have a question about their point of view, and I trust their point of view, I'll pick up the phone and say, "What's your take on this?" Swisher sees her role now less as breaking news about tech companies than interpreting the words and actions of the industry titans she knows very well. Take Musk, for example. They're not on speaking terms. He recently called her an asshole in an email, and yet Swisher has still managed to position herself as the go-to Elon expert. She's even featured herself as the guest for an On episode titled Elon Musk, Somebody That I Used to Know. Swisher's executive producer and on-air sidekick, Naima Raza, conducted the interview. Swisher similarly served as interviewee on a recent Zuckerberg episode, and as with Musk, takes on the role of tech industry conscience. Part of the power of her podcast is there's a sense of somebody who has been here the whole time and is kind of fed up, says tech journalist Casey Newton, who considers Swisher a mentor as well as a landlord. He rents her guest cottage in San Francisco. The often blurry line between Swisher the insider and Swisher the reporter is precisely her appeal. Kara is sort of in constant text conversation with half the planet, and it's a thrill to realize that that's what's buzzing in your pocket, says Haskell. I got my own glimpse of this over the course of reporting this piece, as I'd get random texts from Swisher at all hours, weighing in on the media topic du jour, and once accidentally roping me into a group chat with her agents. Those who socialize with her in the Capitol describe her in a perpetual state of gathering string. She knows everybody, and she gets invited everywhere because she's fun, says legendary Washington journalist and host Sally Quinn, whose late husband, Ben Bradley, hired Swisher to the Post. She also has an incredible bullshit detector, which is always helpful in Washington, Quinn adds. Swisher is in the middle of writing her memoir about covering the early days of the Internet. It's taking her a while, because in addition to all these children, jobs, and heart surgeries, she tells me, I don't like the people I'm writing about anymore. A few weeks later, at an absurdly late hour, she texted that she just finished her chapter on Jeff Bezos. Tomorrow, Rupert, she added. As part of a two-book deal, Swisher also hopes to write a book with her brother, the Dr. Jeffrey Swisher, about the science of living forever. At the moment, she's also working on a documentary about AOL with Left Right Productions. It's a great concept, and I'm the only one who can help them, and a scripted show about tech with Bloomberg's Brad Stone, who is doing the screenwriting. They have a showrunner, so we'll see if we sell it, says Swisher. She's also been advising Post News, a social network founded by former Waze CEO Noam Barden, and has been encouraging people to join it on Twitter. I would like a viable competitor to Twitter by an entrepreneur I respect, Swisher says. I hate that there's one Twitter. And again, the listener must remember that this article went to press before Twitter became X. Swisher says she tries to structure her deals where I get a piece of it for my success. For Pivot, she received Vox Media stock that can be converted to cash after 4 years. With On, she owns the IP, has a minimum salary, and they share the revenue after cost. I think reporters are super uncomfortable talking about money, and I'm not at all, she said. I really hate that journalists don't understand business. If you don't understand the economics of what's happening, you're effed. She clearly, through her journalism, understood not only the value but the power of intellectual property while covering what others were doing in that space. Disney CEO Bob Iger, who has bantered with Swisher both offstage and on for years, tells me, There she was, with a front row seat to the mining of great intellectual property, using technology, really, as a means of creating value, he says, adding that Swisher, in effect, turned the results of her own reporting on herself. In February 2022, Galloway and Swisher held the inaugural Pivot Conference, in which they both have an ownership stake. It was not a financial success. It was very expensive to put on, Galloway tells me. They've held other live Pivot events, including in Germany and London in January, but are still figuring out what's next. About half of Pivot's audience is Gen Z or Millennial, with more than 70% in the 18 to 49 age bracket, according to a Vox Media spokesperson. One idea is going to business schools, where Swisher says Pivot has a crazy fan base, and creating some sort of networking occasion. Something else besides people sitting in an effing ballroom, she says. Even with so many projects swirling in the present, Swisher has an eye toward posterity. In history, they're going to watch that Gates and Jobs interview. 100 years from now, that's how we got them to do it, really, she told me. They're going to watch all these interviews. It's like you had Thomas Edison and I challenged him. Rather than what grows up around them, the mythology, you'll be able to hear them being interviewed by someone who was good at interviewing. Now here's Keziah Weir on books. Lens Flare, Lush Coffee Table Books invite the reader to revel in the details. Atelier of Europe. Writer John Whelan and photographer Oscar Proctor captures the magic of 28 European ateliers, replica statuary crowd, a Rome workshop, pictured here. A Paris studio specializes in decorative paint and glimmers in gold. Published by Prestel. Chronorama. This sumptuous volume couples with a Palazzo Grassi exhibition of 20th century art from the Condé Nast archive, including photographs by Diane Arbus, Helmut Newton, and as pictured here, an illustration of a model by George Wolf Planck from a 1917 edition of Vanity Fair, published by Abrams. Richard Avedon, Relationships, a display of more than 100 of the late seminal photographer's works in fashion, as in this 1970 shot of the model Jean Shrimpton in an evening gown, and portraiture from Malcolm X to Linda Evangelista, published by Skira. Onyx, a famed Houston strip club, lends its name to Adrian Raquel's glimmering monograph, which celebrates the performance and artistry of its dancers, published by Damiani, DAP. Splash! Mermaids are having a moment in the cultural slipstream. Forget what you know about mermaids, commands Ren Yu, the teen narrator of Jade Song's Blood-Soaked Chlorine, published by William Morrow, calling to mind and dismissing red-haired Ariel and pre-Raphaelite beauties. The directive is a fitting tagline for a crop of new novels with resonances that lean more Homeric than Disney and narratives geared toward a plugged-in audience. Halle Bailey, star of the forthcoming live-action The Little Mermaid, has said the film, too, will be updated with the current times. Chlorine sees a high school swimmer go to drastic lengths to assume what she believes is her true form. In Cassandra Kaw's Taut, Bewitching, The Salt Grows Heavy, published by Tor Nightfire, a mermaid is betrayed by her husband. Their daughters devour his body and destroy his kingdom. And in Julia Langbein's American Mermaid, published by Doubleday, when a Hollywood studio adapts and drains the salty life force from a novel about a wheelchair-bound mermaid, fiction collides with real life. The creatures have traded languid hair combing for power brokering on their own terms. It's a welcome title shift. This program is intended for a blind and print impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast at our website, www.ncreadingservice.org. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.